Chapter 15. In a month filled with firsts, what Katie Frey was doing at the moment was not only a first for her, it was a first for the entire merry band of pirates. Her first that month had been earning the shameful DNF award for did not finish in the adventure race, something that had never happened to her. In one race several years before, she had stepped in a muddy hole and twisted an ankle a half mile into a 10-mile race, and after determining she could still walk, she kept running. She had won that race, and the people in the medical tent told her she probably hadn't done additional damage by continuing to run. The damage would come later when the ankle got stiff. Even if she had to walk to the finish line, a possibility because the buses had already left the starting area when she hurt her ankle, she had been determined not to quit that race just because she rolled her ankle. Yet she could not argue that her first DNF was for a very good and legitimate reason. Going into space had been another first, a very big one. So had been committing mutiny, although technically she had been on leave at the time, and technically the Canadian government had not banned her from joining the Merry Band of Pirates, or her government had issued those orders but they were filtered out by a beer can. Either way, her conscience on the subject was clear. Wearing and even touching a Krystang mech suit was another first in the positive column. There had been a lot of firsts recently. The current first was decidedly not her favorite, nor was it the favorite of her aching back.
"Skippy," she groaned through gritted teeth. "Flex up more, please."
"No can do, Katie. Sorry about that," the beer can replied with sympathy. "You have long legs, and I can't adjust the gate without your backpack bumping the structure above. Can you stand it another minute?"
"Yep," she gasped from the pain.
The vertebrae in her spine felt like they were grinding into each other, creating a sharp pain that she knew was a bad sign. From training for endurance races, she was long used to pain in the form of dull aches, and knew dull pain was a sign of overused and fatigued muscles and joints. Sharp pains were a sign of something seriously wrong and serious damage being created. If the mission were not life and death, she would have stopped. She did not stop. The pain was not caused by any lack of fitness. It was caused by emotion that was awkward and not anything she had done since she was a very young girl. Perhaps the real problem was the unplanned nature of what she was doing. Skippy had only minutes to reprogram two suits for their mad dash mission after Smythe informed the alien AI of his lunatic plan. Skippy jokingly called the suit's modified and untested gait Rocket Baby. The name came from the common human experience of setting a baby on the floor, turning away for one freaking second, and turning back to see the infant had somehow done an Olympic sprint on hands and knees headed straight for whatever was the closest possible danger. Katie in the lead and Smythe right behind her were crawling on hands and knees in an awkward motion neither of them had trained for, and it was absolutely killing her back. After Skippy glitched the cameras covering the end of the garage wing, the two had made a mad dash out of the crawler's side door and around the end of that wing of the base, ducking down just before they would have been seen by cameras on the adjacent wing radiating out from the base's central hub. When Smythe learned the best access point for plugging the access device into the base computer was in the wing to the right of the crawler garage, he saw there was no way to get across the open ground between wings without an alarm being raised, even with the rest of the team creating havoc elsewhere. He also saw a possible way to reach their objective without being detected. Except for the garages and dropship hangars on the end of opposite wings, the above-ground portions of the base were built on top of support walls sunk into the lunar soil. To accommodate the structure expanding in the heat of direct sunlight, the upper structure partially floated on the support wall and extended outward a meter and a half on each side. With the local star creating deep and sharp shadows under the structure, Smythe thought he could reach his objective by remaining under the overhang. The concealment of the overhang was a vulnerability known to the Bosphorak. Smythe had been assured by Skippy that the bird brains thought a ground attack so unlikely, half of the planned sensors under the structure had never been installed, and he could glitch the others. So far, Smythe's plan was working, except for the problem that the overhang was on average less than 74 centimeters high, with spots as skinny as 66 centimeters. Wearing suits, the distance from knees to the top of their backpacks was 2 centimeters too small for Smythe, and slightly less for Katie. To fix the problem, Skippy the beer can, who had never moved on his own, programmed their suits to crawl with knees and hands splayed to the sides, and that was why Katie's wrists,
elbows, shoulders, knees, hips, and back hurt, even though she was more of a passenger as the suit moved on its own. Having the suit's motion controlled by a hastily programmed computer made the situation worse, as neither suit occupant could do anything to adjust their motion to avoid damaging something important. This was the craziest damn thing she had ever done, possibly the craziest damned thing she had ever heard of, crawling like a super-fast baby under the overhang of an alien moon base on an alien moon in an alien star system thousands of light-years from Earth wearing an alien mech suit. The oddest part of the whole experience was that the above-ground portion of the moon base was brightly colored in psychedelic patterns like the cover of a particularly trippy 60s rock album. The Bosphorok favored garish colors on everything that did not need muted tones for the purpose of stealth, and the designers must have been thrilled to do whatever they wanted with the moon base, because its fixed position could not ever be concealed anyway. As she, or rather the suit, carried her under its own guidance, reached the connector between wings of the base and turned sharply to the right, her faceplate lit up with an alert that the star team had just emerged from the crawler and the entire base now knew about the wholly unexpected attack. Skippy had already told them the stealth field was active and that he was controlling all communications into and out of the moon base, and that so far the Bosphorok were unaware the moon base was encased in a very sophisticated stealth field that was feeding false images. "Wow! That was good shooting," Skippy muttered in her ear. "Captain Poole has the teams on the move." "Enemy reaction?" Smythe asked, his voice unsteady as the jolting motion of speed crawling made it difficult to speak evenly. "Complete and utter panic, of course. At first, the control center thought the data coming in was an error. I'm still glitching systems when I can, so none of their data is reliable, and it is understandable the duty officer could not believe the base was under attack with absolutely no warning. Now all the bird brains are totally panicked. They were completely unprepared for a ground assault, and they know how vulnerable they are. The duty officer ordered the two fighters on ready alert to launch, but there appears to be a glitch that has gotten the fighter bay doors stuck partially open. Now the base commander is worried that all the circuit failures they experienced recently were part of an enemy plot to infiltrate the base. He's wrong, of course, but worrying about that has him distracted, and that works for us. Damn, I wish I could take credit for those circuit failures. Hey, maybe I can tell Joe it was me burning out those circuits." Smythe cut through the beer can's bullshit. "Outside reaction?" "That is not a problem. Yet. Not a problem yet. The moon base sent out a call for help, which of course I intercepted, but the base commander thinks help is on the way, and all Bosphorok outside the stealth field are unaware there is anything wrong on the moon. Doing my best here, but I suggest you proceed with alacrity."
"Alacrity?"
"Yeah. Why? That's a fancy way to say move with eager and enthusiastic quickness, and you stuffy Brits are fond of—" "Captain Poole's team has gotten into a spot of bother. I'm going to concentrate on that. Good luck to you, Colonel Smythe."
"Frey."
Smythe's voice was shaky, not from fear, but from the jostling of their awkward high-speed crawl. He was concerned about what Skippy would define as a spot of bother, and he also could not take time to study the data from Poole's suit sensors. The Rangers team was engaged with the enemy. All three suits plus their combat had sustained damage, and that was all Smythe needed to know. 21 seconds had elapsed since the star team burst out of the crawler, and at any second, someone outside the stealth field might discover there was something odd about the fake sensor data Skippy was sending out. The powerful weapons buried under the moon needed to be fired before the two orbiting battle stations and the research base on the planet could activate their energy shields.
"With me."
Smythe resumed manual control of his suit, rolling to the right to get clear of the overhang, and sprung to his feet, the suit automatically reducing power to avoid him jumping too high in the low gravity. He was up and sprinting for the target before Katie pushed herself to her feet, but she put on a burst of speed and was at his side in four long strides. Katie swung her rifle up, having pre-selected the rocket launcher and set a pair of rockets to wide dispersal explosive mode. The skin of the base buildings above ground were not armored, as the designers had placed all the truly vital and vulnerable items below ground and behind thick composite armor. She did not have to be particularly accurate with her aim. The rifle had been fed the designated secondary target before she left the crawler. A light squeeze of one finger on her left hand authorized the weapons. In quick succession, one then another rocket were spat out of the tube, propelled first by comparatively gentle electromagnets then by the solid rocket motors kicking in. The first rocket delayed its ignition to wait for the second unit to catch up so they could maximize their firepower. Despite there being less than 40 meters to the target, the rockets were moving side by side at over 2,000 kilometers per hour when they got within 3 meters of the wildly colored alien structure. The warheads detonated with the force directed forward in 2 overlapping cone shapes, shredding an oval tear in the outer wall. Air and debris rushed out, moisture in the air simultaneously boiling and freezing as it was exposed to hard vacuum. Katie's suit sensors saw right through the clouds of dust and frozen vapor, providing her a clear, synthetic image as she instinctively blinked when debris thrown at her by the back blast pinged off her suit. Hugging the rifle to her chest, she increased her stride length, then pushed off with one leg to leap upward 5 meters, going in through the hole made by the rocket she fired. As she landed, trusting her suit to make her boots grip the damaged surface of what used to be an interior floor, she felt a thump beside her, knowing that was Smythe following right on her heels. She did not bother announcing clear, as the area was very much not clear of enemy activity. 2 Bosphorak lay dead or dying, their bloody, unprotected bodies shattered by the explosions and decompression. Neither of the 2 enemy were wearing any type of environment suit, instead being clothed in coverall that were shades of muted pastels rather than the garish colors of the structure. With her rifle switched back to explosive-tipped rounds and another rocket ready for fragmentation mode, she ran forward, relying on the enhanced vision provided by suit sensors. There was an explosion ahead to her right. Her trigger finger took up slack as she judged in a flash whether to shoot. The hallway ahead was already damaged, and they could not risk hitting the data port where Skippy needed to be plugged in, or the mission would fail completely. Another shower of sparks showed Katie the explosion had been a power circuit shorting out, not hostile activity directed at her, and her finger relaxed ever so slightly. Their impromptu sprint across the last stretch of open ground had brought them in through the secondary objective, farther from the vital data port, and a part of Katie's mind wondered if Smythe had erred in running rather than continuing to crawl. That the sprint had covered ground rapidly was not in question. Katie's concern was that running along the blast-damaged hallway was so frustratingly slow, she might have been able to run just as fast without the assistance of powered armor. Her unassisted speed in the powered armor was impressive for a human, but it was too slow for a desperate operation against a technologically superior species like the Bosphorak. The hallway was littered with debris cluttering the floor and hanging down from the ceiling, impeding her progress. Her unenhanced human eyes and slow organic brain could not cope quickly enough with the data projected on the inside of her helmet faceplate, and her reflexes were too slow. Katie had been an athlete since she was a little girl playing soccer and hockey and prided herself on peak fitness. Now she swallowed her pride for the good of the mission. "Suit, sprint mode to objective," she gasped. "Engage." The rocket fired by Lauren Poole found some sort of target when it flew down the holes knocked into the walls by enemy fire. She knew that from the backblast of fire and warhead shrapnel. If she had time, she could have replayed data from the last microseconds of the rocket's life to see what it had seen and what it had hit. Unfortunately, the rocket's impact was decidedly on the bad side of the good news-bad news equation. The rocket had hurt the enemy. It had also alerted the enemy that at least one of the invaders was still alive and combat effective, and that prompted an immediate response. Fire from some type of kinetic weapon began tearing the wall apart, ripping holes that stitched a line back toward Poole's position. In response, she leapt upward to cling to the ceiling upside down with the gecko grip palms of her gloves and the knee pads. Sensing what she wanted to do, even if the suit computer was questioning her sanity, it gripped and released as she scrambled along the ceiling past where the enemy fire was pouring in. She dropped down at the intersection of the hallway to take advantage of the thin concealment there. While the suit's stabilizers helped keep her from fatally tumbling into the intersection, she was nearly bowled over by her own combat as it raced past her. The machine had freed itself from the wall it had become partly embedded in, and removed from the restrictions of direct command by a human, was racing to engage the enemy threat in its fully autonomous suicide mode. A coldly analytical part of Lauren Poole's mind flashed a thought that she was about to see which type of robotic weapon was superior in the fight between a Bosphorak killbot against her Theranin combot. The Bosphorok battlefield robots were set up as self-directed robotic war machines called killbots, which made their own decisions based on minimal or no direction from their organic masters. The Theranin had experienced too many incidents over many years where the Maxulks or Rindaloo had hacked into robotic weapons and turned them against their owners, so the Theranin did not trust their robotic killing machines to operate independently. The Theranin controlled their combots via cybernetic implants because the organic parts of Theranin brains could not be hacked, although even the genetically boosted responses of a Theranin brain were slow compared to purely artificial minds. When the Merry Band of Pirates took over the Flying Dutchman, they at first controlled their stolen combots using the crude method of hand gestures communicated through and interpreted by Skippy. Later, the beer can had wiped the original programming completely and installed his own sophisticated code that allowed the deadly machines to be partly guided by slow-reacting humans, or to be directed toward targets and operate largely on their own. The combat brought along by Pool's team had been given authority to do whatever it needed to stop oncoming enemy killbots, because she knew no human could keep up with a machine-to-machine fight. Her snap judgment to engage the combat's suicide mode was the right call, a fact confirmed when the combat blew past her, a metallic tentacle clipping her left elbow and spinning her away. Just as the machine cleared the corner of the hallway, it encountered a larger, heavier enemy killbot, and the two machines poured fire at each other. Then they were so close their energy shields crackled and flickered off. The opponents collided violently, rounds alternating in armor-piercing and explosive-tipped modes tearing holes at each other. The Moonbase Killbot's main autogun was hit and jammed just as a round from the pirate's combat exploded inside the barrel of the enemy's main weapon, blowing a chunk out of the Bosphorok device and knocking Pool back off her feet. With their autoguns disabled or missing and being too close to employ rockets or grenade launchers, and with both machines having decided firing masers would be much too close to cause enough damage during their remaining very short lifespans, the brains of the dueling robots ran through billions of calculations to determine the best course of action. Deep inside well-armored casings, each machine had a sophisticated computer brain, and their processors sent signals coursing through quantum gates at the speed of light. The Bosphorok machine had the crucial advantage of knowing it had a companion right behind, while the invading machine was apparently alone, so the defending killbot needed only to delay the invader. In less than a nanosecond, the lead killbot decided to grapple the invader in a move that meant certain death for itself and certain victory for its masters. The grappling arms deployed. If the pirate's combat had used its originally totally amateurish, crappy, and there are no words to describe how bad the original Theranin programming was, that combat would have been pinned to the other machine and effectively out of the fight. Instead, because the pirate's combat had been programmed by Skippy the Magnificent, and because the beer can in his groovy man cave aboard the starship was watching and able to provide instant analysis through the micro-wormhole connection, that combat reached its own decision long before the enemy machine ground its way through quantum gateways. In an inventive move worthy of Joe Bishop-style monkey-brain thinking, the combat tilted upward and deployed a harpoon that was designed for use to anchor it in place. The harpoon was used in a way its designers never intended, and in a way that was quite effective, for the harpoon's sharp blade, only 3 molecules thick at the cutting surfaces, sliced into the enemy machine's armor casing, shattering the tough composite material and cracking the killbot's main processor. Now was a good time for a maser, the combat realized, a creepy tentacle snapping around in front of the temporarily spasming enemy and pouring high-energy photons into the casing, frying the hostile killbot's computer core until it was not hostile at all, being a melted slag of rare minerals and exotic particles. With the enemy immobile, and knowing that happy situation would last only until backup processors took over, the combat retracted the harpoon's barbs and withdrew the projectile, picking up the enemy machine. That the Bosphorok killbot was made of tough stuff became evident as it began to struggle, weakly at first, then with more authority. The combat took only half a second to pick up and heave the partly disabled killbot, feeling the machine shudder as it was struck from behind by weapons fire from its companion. Without emotion, the failed killbot had instructed its companion to fire through it if possible, anything to get to the invader. Friendly fire struck it repeatedly, breaking parts off and making the combat's grip precarious. When the stricken machine was flung through the air, it calculated that its best chance to help before dying was to overload its power cells, an event deadlier to the damaged invader than to its still-shielded companion. No matter how much smarter and faster thinking the Combot was, it could not escape being surprised by the sudden buildup of power inside the enemy's power cells, even as it tossed the half-dead machine through the air. Nor could it escape the shockwave that threw it backwards despite its attempt to reuse the harpoon for its intended purpose of anchoring it to the floor. The force of the explosion deflected the harpoon in flight, bending its course downward and to the side, so it glanced off the floor and stuck into the wall. The wall being made of comparatively flimsy material, the harpoon instantly tore loose, though its barbs were out at full extent, the recoil making it fly back to strike its owner. The Combot was not without resources, for even as it was struck by heavy weapons fire that tore into its vital areas and it began to lose power, it ripple-fired its own weapons, launching everything it had, for it knew that was its only possibility for staying in the fight. Both Invader and Defender were knocked about violently. The Combot being thrown back into the wall it had only seconds ago extracted itself from, the second Killbot staggering backward and its energy shield generators overheating and failing in a rapid cascade from absorbing kinetic rounds at point-blank range. There was a microsecond when the opponents took time to lick their wounds, meaning their central processors switched to backup circuits and rerouted power connections away from depleted and failing power cells. Sensors reset, temporarily blinded by the furious energies flaring in what was left of the hallways. The lone remaining Defender jumped forward, having observed that its brain must be slower than the invader, and calculating it needed to close the distance quickly to get a kill shot while its sensors came back online with agonizing slowness. Guessing where the invader must be, it swung its main autocannon around and was struck from the left by two rockets, followed by a hail of rounds from what had to be two infantry rifles, then another pair of rockets, and another. The Defender had a judgment call to make. Which was the bigger threat? It was programmed to consider only the threat to its masters, to the base it was programmed to protect, and not to itself. Two enemy soldiers with infantry weapons were certainly less dangerous than what the Defender recognized as a Theran in combat, particularly as... What the hell? The Killbot was astonished when its analysis confirmed the infantry rifles being used against it were effective but relatively crude Kristang weapons? Why were Kristang attacking a Bosphorak facility? No. Scratch that. The real question was how any group of Kristang had the guts to take on a mission against a secure Bosphorak. The Defender could wonder later about why a mixture of Theranin and Kristang weapons were being used by the invaders, if there was a later. From the impacts it was sustaining on its armored forward surfaces, it knew the invader Combot had reset its sensors more quickly and was targeting the Defender's known vulnerable areas. While its own sensors were still lollygagging on the couch wearing fuzzy slippers and munching on a whole box of sweets instead of rebooting and doing something useful, the Defender did not need sensors to determine the invading Combot's location. It only needed to fire back in the direction the maser beams were coming from. So it did that, launching rockets followed closely by everything else it had. Masers, particle beams, and auto gun. Poole was firing from the prone position where she had been thrown when the first enemy Killbot exploded itself. Her own suit was experiencing problems with sensor inputs. There were a few tiny punctures through the tough armor, and several of the power assist motors were offline. While the two killing machines fought each other, it was best for soft and vulnerable humans to stay out of the way, and enough ordnance was ricocheting around to make it dangerous for her and Rourke to be close to the battle area. They remained observers only for the 3 seconds it took for the enemy Killbot to come into view, then Poole hit it with rockets and emptied her magazine at the frightening thing, seeing rockets and rounds from Rourke also striking the deadly machine. With her rockets expended and her magazine empty, she rolled to one side to reach back for a fresh magazine, her smart rifle automatically ejecting the spent magazine to go clattering across the floor. "I'm out!" she shouted to warn Rourke. And from the fact that soldier was also not firing, she knew he was also in the act of inserting a fresh magazine. Their own Combot was dead. Laura knew that from the glaring red icon on her faceplate, and from seeing the valiant machine slumped on the floor, torn in half, unmoving, except for when it jerked from being struck by enemy fire. The dead combat stopped moving entirely when the enemy killbot, itself gravely wounded and lying on its side with its legs blown off, decided the invader machine was no longer a threat and turned its attention to the pair of Krestang armored suits. Lauren's gloved fingers found the magazine cartridge, and a fully loaded magazine ejected itself into her hand, her arm swinging around as the killbot's smoking autogun swung toward her, and her vision lit up with the blue glow of a Bosphorok targeting laser, and she knew she and Rourke were dead. Katie saw the data port first, her being half astride in front of Smythe as planned because he was carrying the all-important micro-wormhole. They each carried the specially made jack that needed to be plugged into the data port so Skippy could insert his presence into the alien computer remotely through the micro-wormhole connection. The jack would not be necessary if Skippy himself had come along on the mission, but no one wanted to risk the beer can going with the ground team, and he could perform almost his full range of awesomeness through the micro-wormhole in Smythe's backpack. Without wasting a ragged breath to speak, Katie I-clicked to return her suit to manual control from the headlong race of sprint mode where the suit had moved on its own and Katie had been a mere passenger. Dropping to her knees, she skidded along the floor to crash into the wall, her powered gloves bending the wall material to arrest her slide. Both of her gloves had recessed holders for the custom jacks, and she carried six others in her belt, the back of her helmet, and in her backpack. The spares were thankfully not needed. When she made a fist of her left hand and bumped it against the data port opening, the little jack sprung from its recessed holder and guided itself into the port. A green light on the outside of the jack glowed to indicate the port was active and the connection successful.
"Skippy, do your thing,"
she choked out the words, sucking in air to replenish her depleted lungs.
"Huh? What? Oh, sorry. I got bored while nothing much was happening, so I'm working on a devilishly difficult New York Times crossword puzzle from 1914. Man, the cultural references from that long ago are tough to understand. Hey, maybe you can help. What is a seven-letter word for do your bloody job?" Smythe roared in outrage.
"Okay, okay. Jeez Louise, you monkeys are impatient. I'll do it.
Remind me, what exactly am I supposed to do here?"
The blue targeting laser was still lighting up her faceplate as Lauren slammed a fresh magazine into her rifle and felt the slight jolt as the weapon automatically chambered around and released the safety. Krestang weapons, especially those reprogrammed by Skippy, were smart, and hers knew she was in combat, so she did not need to waste time on useless motions. The rifle had been on its side, the muzzle pointed away from the enemy killbot so she could access the magazine opening. As her rifle swung in agonizingly slow motion toward the target, she saw the machine had rolled farther toward her so its damaged autogun could get line of sight to its first target. Her. As her finger took up slack on the trigger, the autogun jerked, and she instinctively flinched to prepare for violent death. Except the autogun's muzzle kept swinging until it pointed down at the floor and the entire enemy machine slumped. There was a whining sound as its mechanisms powered down. In between breaths, Lauren felt herself shudder involuntarily, and she deliberately lifted her finger away from the trigger.
"Hold," she whispered to Rourke. "Don't waste ammo. That thing is dead."
"Nope," the voice of Skippy broke in cheerily. There had been no communication with the annoying beer can since Smythe had sprinted away, his team maintaining strict communication silence to avoid being detected. "I turned it off. Well, technically, all I did was sever its connection to the base defense system, but same difference. Anywho," he announced as Poole and Rourke stood up in a wary crouch, "behold the magic of Skippy the Magnificent. Wow, you made a real mess in there. And you got my combat killed. I'm severely disappointed. You were supposed to be elite warriors. I expected you to show me a professional." Poole's left glove tightened around the rifle stock, and she unknowingly echoed a comment from Smythe.
"I've got something to show you right here. Why don't you come down here so I can—"
"Love to, babe, but there is a Bosphorok in a mech suit coming around the corner, so you might want to—" Neither Poole nor Rourke needed an engraved invitation. With Skippy in full command of the base AI, their suit computers were beginning to receive input from the base's interior sensors, while the Bosphorok defenders were finding their own sensor inputs missing or unreliable. The bird brain that stepped cautiously around the corner, placing its feet carefully on the debris-choked field, was responding to sensor data showing the invaders were all dead. If that Bosphorok had lived,
it would have learned a valuable lesson never to trust a beer can. But alas, a fusillade of armor-piercing and explosive-tipped rounds slammed into it before it could see with its own eyes that its sensor feed was total bullshit. With the enemy still falling backwards in a spray of blood, Poole was already leaping through the thin air, so by the time the enemy's helmet rebounded off the floor, she had landed both knees on its chest with her rifle jammed into the neck of its armored suit. A squeeze of the trigger would have sent a 3-round burst into the dying enemy, but her rifle judged the second and third rounds were not needed and cut off the ammo feed.
"Damn," Rourke said softly as the enemy's helmet and head separated from its body to go spinning off back up the side hallway.
"Making sure?"
"Adrenaline," Poole explained, and was embarrassed by the momentary but understandable breach of discipline, already turning her attention elsewhere. There were no other killbots in sight. The only movement was from two apparently unarmed Bosphorak down on their knees, gasping for breath in the increasingly thin air. Heavy weapons fire in an above-ground structure was not a good idea for the health and safety of unprotected occupants. She could see tendrils of smoke being whisked away toward holes in the far wall. Without supplemental oxygen, the two enemy would soon be dead of asphyxiation, and even if they had oxygen masks, their bodies would swell up, freeze, and explode from being exposed to partial vacuum. In an act that was driven in part by mercy and in part by standing mission orders, she quickly put a single round in the heads of each fallen enemy and turned away to focus on the next problem.
"Burke! Status!"
Burke was surprised to hear from Poole, because he had assumed she and Rourke would be dead. The last image he had of enemy strength behind him was of two large and powerful killbots and at least one armor-suited biological. When he turned and ran to follow Poole's orders, he thought his teammates would die to keep the killbots off his heels so he could accomplish their assigned part of the mission even though he was alone. His frantic race toward the control center had been impelled by the fear that a killbot would soon be sent after him, and he had been waiting for his suit's proximity sensors to warn him of a threat approaching from behind. Alone against a killbot he could not hope to survive. His plan had been to fire his rifle backwards and keep running, trying to get as close to the control center as possible before he was cut down. The whole mission had been screwed up since their Falcon entered the sensor field around the moon, with too few operators available for too many objectives. When Smythe and Frey ran off on their own, Burke feared the team had lost the combat power to penetrate through to the control center, and those fears were confirmed when Poole and Rourke had been forced to fight a delaying battle against a strong defense.
"How are you alive?"
"Later," Poole barked. "Progress."
"Minimal resistance," Burke reported.
He had encountered only 4 Bosphorak along the way, and only one of them was armed, though not wearing armor. His rifle had made quick work of dispatching all 4. And again, to his surprise, his faceplate display was showing him 2 more enemy symbols just around a corner to his left. He was not yet familiar with the new system Skippy had uploaded into his suit, so he didn't know how to tell whether the 2 Bosphorak were armed, and he didn't much care. If they weren't holding weapons as he ran past, they might later get access to weapons and pose a threat to the team behind him, and he could not allow that. Saving his precious rockets for future use against hard targets, he held his rifle to the left and squeezed off a short burst as he ran past, the rounds having already been fed targeting coordinates by his suit. By himself, Burke might have been sufficiently accurate to hit the 2 tall figures who were pounding on and screaming at a stuck door at the end of the short hallway. With semi-guided ammunition, he did not need to be concerned about accuracy. The burst of 4 rounds made his rifle chatter and cut off speech until he was past the side hallway and racing onward.
2 more down, he reported,
knowing Poole would have heard the rifle fire picked up by his suit microphones.
Wait for you?
Negative.
Poole's voice was strained, and Burke could see the symbols representing her and Rourke were running flat out behind him.
Go, go, go!
Smythe's faceplate lit up with the confusing images as Skippy established control over the AI that ran the moon base and fed data from the internal sensor network to the Star Team's suits.
Skippy, this is too much.
Smythe had to put out a hand to steady himself against a wall. The visual barrage was making his eyes unfocus and playing haywire with his inner ear, throwing off his balance.
Yeah, hold your horses. I'm working on it.
Your display might blue screen for a moment. I need to tweak the software in your suit computers so it can interpret the data feed and show you only the info you really need.
Wow, I thought the Bosphorak would have better software.
Whoever wrote that code was a total amateur. What a bunch of—
Skippy, Smythe interrupted. We can't have our suit shutting down to reboot. The team would be vulnerable to—
Your suit already rebooted, if that crude term can be used here. You didn't notice the blue screen effect because it happened too fast for your visual cortex to register the image.
Okay, we're good. Your suit checks out.
Now I know how to program the other suits. And done. All team members have updated software.
Grinding his teeth at the arrogant and clueless AI, Smythe put aside fantasies of dropping the beer can into a star and scanned the display, which was now showing concise information he needed without extraneous data. Poole's team had lost their combat, and for some reason had split up, with Burke far ahead near the base control center. There was no significant resistance between Burke and that team's objective, and Poole and Rourke had their suits in maximum speed mode to catch up to the lone soldier racing ahead of them. The Delta team was laying waste to their assigned hangar, rifle rounds having torn into every flyable machine at that location. Nunnally, Grudzian, and Kluse had encountered resistance before reaching their assigned hangar, but their rockets had blown up one dropship and secondary explosions had taken care of the other two spacecraft in the hangar.
Skippy, do we have access to the control center?
No, that place is locked down tight. The bird brains in there reacted with impressive speed. I don't know if they are trained well or just instinctively moved to save their own asses. Your plan did not anticipate this problem, so I do not—
Can you?
Anticipating your next question, by the time Poole arrives, I will have a blast door unlocked and ready to open. To avoid alerting the enemy, I will delay retracting that door until her team is assembled there. You do understand that forcing that door open will unmistakably show the defenders in the control center that they are not merely facing a conventional, if shockingly well-prepared and determined attack. That could be a big problem.
Smythe hit the button to release the bottom of the backpack he carried, carefully holding on to it as it let go of the upper pack.
Why should we care if the opposition understands the nature of the threat we pose to them?
Because the Bosphorak are not stupid. They might guess that we intend to capture the moon base and use its weapons against the research base on the planet. Please do not interrupt me, Skippy added as Smythe opened his mouth to do just that. The big problem is what I just learned from ransacking their computer system. The enemy has a protocol for this very situation. It calls for the command crew here to self-destruct the facility.
Bloody hell.
Making a bad situation worse, the two battle stations have orders to bombard and destroy the moon base in the event it is about to fall under enemy control.
Yes, but those battle stations think everything is fine and normal down here, correct? There is no reason for them to suspect anything is wrong down here.
The battle stations are not the problem. Damn. You know, Joe is a particularly dim-witted monkey, but he would have guessed what I'm trying to tell you by now. You are smarter than Joe. How come you haven't—
Because I don't bloody have time, beer can. Spell it out for me.
Okay. However, I must note that I am very disappointed with you, and this will be noted in your permanent record. Think about this. The duty crew in the command center thinks they have been reporting to the two battle stations that the moon base has been invaded. When I open that blast door, the duty crew will attempt to self-destruct the base, which will not be a problem because I have a team of maintenance bots unplugging the connections to the explosives so the duty crew can press all the buttons they want and nothing will happen. What is a problem is that the duty crew will expect the battle stations to follow orders and bombard the moon. Recognition of the danger smacked Jeremy Smythe in the face.
Oh, shite.
Aha! You get it now? When maser beams from the orbiting battle stations do not start striking the moon base, the duty crew will realize something is very wrong, that maybe all their communications have been compromised despite my best efforts to fool them. When that happens, and it surely will happen, the duty crew will launch rockets to pop up transmitters above the stealth field. The instant the battle stations see those communications rockets emerge from the stealth field, they will stop talking and start hitting the moon with everything they have, and it will be game over for you.
You can disable the self-destruct mechanism. Can you disable those rockets?
Sadly, no. This is a case when I actually am sad when I say sadly instead of being amusingly ironic. Since those rockets were designed as a last-ditch effort, they were also designed to be fail-safe. They use a crude but foolproof solid chemical propellant, and their launch procedure is entirely mechanical. The only way I could intervene is by taking over an enemy bot, and for security, the Bosphorak do not allow remotely controlled bots inside the command center.
Your only hope is to get into the command center and kill the duty crew so quickly they do not have the time to launch those rockets.
Right.
Smythe may not have the inventive mind of Colonel Bishop, but he was a fast thinker and able to adapt to any situation.
Burke, halt! Do not approach the command center!
Burke had turned the last corner and put on a burst of speed down the last hallway to the command center, mildly dismayed to see the blast door there was closed. That contingency had been planned for, so he reached under his rifle to launch a rocket, selecting armor penetration mode. A finger of his left hand had tensed to engage the rocket launch trigger when Smythe's call startled him. Reflexively, his left hand relaxed, and he tried to slow his stride, his legs fighting the action of the suit leg motors. The opposing control input confused the suit for a split second, and his legs became entangled, tripping him and throwing him forward to slide on his chest, then flipping to slide on his back. Windmilling his arms and legs, he caught the edge of a doorway with one powered glove, and its G.I. Joe Kung Fu grip dug into the doorframe, tearing a strip out of the frame and 3 meters of wall before jerking him to a stop. Burke lost no time with being shocked by the turn of events. He stayed focused by throwing his legs out in front of him and using their momentum to pop himself back to his feet.
Halt acknowledged. I am...
He checked the numbers in the upper left corner of the faceplate display.
8 meters from the blast door to the command center. Do not approach, and try not to make any noise there. Poole will join you shortly, and Frey and I are on the way. Wait for us. Do not take any offensive action.
Understood, Burke said automatically, though he most certainly did not understand at all. Switching to a private channel, he called Poole.
What is going on?
From the very first briefing about the current mission, it had been emphasized that speed was everything, that nothing could be allowed to slow down their race to their objectives. That is why Burke had run ahead, thinking he had left Poole and Rourke behind to die. Now he was just supposed to wait?
It's a fluid situation, Lauren advised, using soldier speak to say the team was now making shit up as they went along. If there was a new master plan for the new reality they were confronted with, she was confident Smythe would inform her when she needed to know. She did not have confidence that a new master plan existed yet.
Open that door, Smythe ordered, covering the hallway forward while Frey dropped to one knee and turned the manual latch to unlock the door that came up only to her waist.
As Smythe thought, the door provided access to mechanisms inside that wall, and there was plenty of space for the small pack that contained one end of the micro-wormhole. As Frey took the pack and stuffed it into a corner behind the door, there was a protest.
Hey, Skippy shouted. What are you monkeys doing? I still need that wormhole, duh!
We are leaving it here because the wormhole is vital, Smythe explained. It will be safe hidden behind that door. If I carry it around, and I'm hit...
Oh! Good point, Skippy mumbled sheepishly.
Okay, yep, the wormhole will be fine in there. You two crazy kids have fun on your date. Make sure you're home by 10 o'clock.
Smythe bristled at the beer can, making light of the situation.
This is not a...
I've had worse dates, Frey observed while latching the door securely closed and unslinging her rifle. Ready, sir.
Right. Smythe felt awkward, though he had no reason to. Frey, you take point.